And it is 2 o'clock here on the West Coast, and it is time now for our weekly appointment with Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. Good afternoon, and what is on your mind today, Elizabeth?
That was really smooth, Brad.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad.
I feel invited in. What is on my mind today? Okay. Today is a heavier day. Last week was kind of light and festive, but this week is... I don't know how I can have a conversation about anything. Everything that is being spoken of, whether it's what my grandkids did this weekend or what's happening in my classroom or the fact that my husband's and my water heater blew up this morning and shot water across our kitchen.
Arg!
Yes, but all of those things are under this heavy, heavy shadowed cloud of what's happening in the world around us and proclamations from our current president and unrest in the Middle East and so many overwhelming and upsetting things that are unfolding. Kind of like when you you open, you know, that can and a whole bunch of snakes pops out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's how everything feels, that no matter what we touch, snakes pop out, and that there are many other problems that go along with it. And so I can't have a simple conversation about mental health and well-being, because our mental health and well-being, while it is impacted by our circumstances in our homes and our relationships with our family and our relationship with ourselves and our self-esteem and kind of those regular run-of-the-mill mental health issues that we're used to that kind of, you know, prevent us sometimes from really enjoying our lives. But no matter what state our personal mental health might be in, whether it's pretty stable or kind of the typical ups and downs of depression, anxiety, and some concerns, I don't know, in my sphere, anyone who is not feeling greatly impacted by this cloud of heavy unknown that just kind of is putting a pall over anything that's going on in their life. Because again, today, as the water is shooting out of the water heater across the room and flooding everything, I started to weirdly laugh in this, of course the water heater blew up sort of way, because everything's blowing up around me. And this is just one more metaphor of something that I don't have control over in the moment, that the best I can do is throw my body on the flow of water, which I did, and try to, you know, pat it down. But in the end of the, you know, day, it still flooded the kitchen, no matter how much I laid on the spout. And it kind of feels like that with my students who were talking about family psych, and I'm talking about family systems and, you know, relationships, and 5 of the 10 questions in class are, but what happens if we have World War III, Professor Barrett? What happens? How do I even study and think about what I'm going to do in the future? Because everything right now just feels scary and hopeless. And here I am in the front of this classroom, one professor wanting to throw myself on all of them to protect them or to keep, you know, them from feeling this sense of overwhelm. At the same time, the professional in me also recognizes that everything in life is an opportunity for adaptation and resilience and being able to refigure our circumstances. And you know, I also understand that these things are both true at the same time, that we can be overwhelmed with water shooting out and flooding us and emotions and experiences, and also be gaining experience and resilience and the capacity to take on more than we ever thought we were possible, that was possible for us to take on at the same time. But I don't wish that on any of us. I don't wish that on anyone. I like knowing and having the confidence that when I look at my students and I look at my children and I look at my friends and I look at you, I have full confidence in your capacity to overcome and move forward. But it's the silliness of what we're having to think about and overcome, the ridiculousness of these man-made created disasters, that is so incredibly frustrating, that I have no answer for. And it feels so Captain Kangaroo, which anyone who gets that reference gets an A.
But I'll take my A, please.
Thank you. It is so Captain Kangaroo, childlike. It's we're in this alternative make-believe. I'll even do, you know, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It's like we're living in this weird made-up neighborhood that I keep expecting. And I'm going to do a Twilight Zone on you here. But I keep expecting the cameras to pull back and show that we're just in some fake universe that are being pawns that are moved around, because it just feels ridiculous that no one in their right mind or in their sense of self could feel like the decisions that are being made in, you name it, every category, make no sense. And that's a really difficult thing to sit with. But we're going to, because we have an hour here together. And so in order to kind of address a little piece of the fire hose of information that's being shot out into the world, fortunately, my good friend Kyle Berlin is in town. And Kyle is a beloved part of the show and a beloved part of our family from the time he was, I think, 9 or 10 years old. And now he's a grown man of 30. He graduated from Rio Grande High School and went to Princeton. He was a valedictorian at Princeton, and only a mother in closeness can say that with great pride like I do. Fabulous. And he's gone on now for the last 10 years to be creating really unique pieces of art, which he calls documentary playwriting, and taking oral histories and stories from different communities and then creating these really powerful plays about that issue. And one of the most recent ones was about the oak tree dilemma in Napomo, in the big building, the big development that's going out there. Beautifully done. So Kyle's in town this week because he's just finished his latest project about the Arab American community and our area, and oral histories that he's taken and created another beautiful show to express their experiences. And it's going to be here on the Central Coast on Thursday. And so I invited Kyle to come in and talk about this art form that he's crafted over the last decade and this particular project. And then, because neither one of us are really experts in any of this, we're going to talk about what's happening in the Middle East and what we think is going to happen. And like everyone else, how we get up every day and do the regular routines of our lives with this whole background noise of things that feel incredibly out of our control happening. So this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you are also welcome to be part of our conversation today by getting on the phone at 805-781-3875, or you can send an email to me after the show to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram, although I don't do much on them. I'm always happy to read any messages or notes you send me there. And you're also welcome to find previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. Many years of shows are there. Or you may podcast our show or share the show with others by sending them to Spotify or NPR podcasts or Apple podcasts. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe. And if you leave a review, it helps other people find the show as well. And we'd like to grow the show, so that would be much appreciated. But for now, we're going to take a quick break and come back and begin our conversation with Kyle Berlin right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts escaping, home, where my music's playing, home, where my love lies waiting silently for.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And I don't know why, but that song kind of choked me up today. There's the simpleness in the whole melody. It's like, oh, yes, I just want to be sitting in a park somewhere listening to Simon and Garfunkel sing to me. Good afternoon, Kyle Berlin.
Hi, Elizabeth. It's great to be here.
I'm glad that you're here. So as I mentioned before, you and I have a long history. I've watched you grow up into the fine young man that you are. And you've taken on many different creative ventures over the years, but it seems like you've found kind of this style of expressing yourself artistically. And I used the term documentary playwright, but can you talk a bit about how you found your way to doing this work? What inspired it as opposed to just being strictly a playwright or a creative writer or writing novels? Like, why this?
Great question. Well, I love fiction and I like making things up. And, you know, a lot of my early experience with you was when I was in elementary and middle and high school doing improv and making up stories with your daughter and my friend and, you know, making things up totally super creative and wild and zany. And I love that. But then in college, I discovered more, you know, the power of true stories.
And what was your major? I don't even know it.
I was a Spanish and Portuguese major.
Okay.
And that just sort of happened by accident because I was studied abroad in Cuba and fell in love with the language and the culture broadly. So,
but the writing then was always kind of an interest, but not your primary.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've always had a penchant for words and for storytelling in different capacities. But it was in the middle of college I got this motivated to apply for this Projects for Peace grant. And I talked to my good friend, Ashlyn Hatch, who I went to Arroyo Grande High School with, and she is studying theater at Reed College, and she had been experimenting with this type of verbatim documentary theater where you basically interview-based or, you know, doing interviews or drawing from real stories, from real people, their real words as they spoke them in different contexts, and then remixing them basically, almost like a disc jockey, in a different context, in a theatrical context. And so she and I and another Arroyo Grande High School grad, McColmy Alexander Hills, we started this theater company called Rhizome Theater Company and did our inaugural production about the town of Arroyo Grande, where we all grew up. And we called it Nice Town, Normal People. And it was a kind of deep dive into the culture of the place and the contradictions and the myths that underlie any kind of sense of community. So that was the kind of origin story. And then, you know, we've all have morphed into different versions of ourselves and are doing different versions of our own creative practice in different ways. But I keep returning to this mode of documentary storytelling.
I know, because what are some of the places? The first one was the AG. Mm-hmm. And was that part of the piece fellowship then? That was how you used that grant?
Yeah.
So what did that lead to then? What other places or topics have you touched on?
Yeah, so that we did that summer in 2017, which was an interesting time because it was, you know, just after Trump was elected for the first time. And so there was a lot of, you know, soul searching in the country and whatnot.
And division in neighborhoods
totally.
And communities. Yeah.
And it prefigured a lot of the, it's interesting going back to that play now and seeing how much of the unrest around Black Lives Matter in 2020 and immigration debates and violence, which is ongoing now, how much that was already very much expressed in the words of Arroyo Grande residents in 2017. So that play, we ended up touring it around the country because we kept doing it in different places and people saying, wait a minute, this reminds me of my town, my small town in this random part of rural Maine or you know, in Southern California or other places which are very far away in space from Arroyo Grande, but something about this kind of small town dynamic of, on the one hand, acceptance and intimacy and community, and on the other hand, discrimination, closed-mindedness, intolerance. And it's kind of a tale as old as time in a way.
You do the actual AG story in other communities, or did you go to the communities and do their story?
A mix. We found it quite potent to do a version of the AG story, slightly shortened, you know, for them and sort of as almost an act of sharing and vulnerability of, look, this is our community and this is what we found in this place where we're all from. And then we would work with them in developing their own short documentary theater piece about their community. And, you know, they would then present or read reflections that they gathered from their neighbors and from their community about that particular place. So then it was a little bit like an exchange in theatrical form.
Mm-hmm. And so here we are almost a decade later. And what kind of projects, I mean, how have your projects changed in the last 5 or 6 years? And I imagine during the pandemic, you had to really change how you were expressing yourself creatively as well.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the pandemic was definitely a jarring transition for because we were so invested in mm-hmm. gathering people together
exactly.
in rooms. And for years, that was challenging. And frankly, I don't think it's been the same ever since. I think people, especially younger people, and there's just a slight – there's a different feeling in the air that when it has to do with gathering, I think.
With young people? Because I would have first thought older people don't want to go out and be too close to each other still.
Maybe you would speak to this better than I would as a college professor with young people, though. There's this sort of COVID generation kind of social anxiety that I think maybe has to do with, not missing a kind of critical stage of sociality, of being with other people, the remoteness of constant Zooms and FaceTimes and things, not having that kind of physical co-presence at a formative time.
I think that's so true, because that comes up a lot in class, and I use the term Zoom face.
Yeah.
I'll tell the students, when I look out and I'm lecturing, you're giving me Zoom face. It's as if you're not there and you think I'm on a screen, and it's hard for me to lecture to you because there's no energy coming back. So I wonder if you experience that when you're doing a play. Do you get Zoom face of audiences then?
Well, they talk about have you heard about the Gen Z stare?
Well, it must be Zoom face.
Exactly. Well, it's like this kind of blank face, like
yes.
Shut down. And partly I think it's a kind of resistance to
anything,
to like modes of expression or that they find outdated or rude or non-responsive. So they just give non-response to non-response in a way.
Like a fear of being called out for expressing themselves?
Or a kind of disapproval of that is expressed by refusing to engage, which I think can be a valid tool. Sometimes it's you just don't want to waste your energy.
Yeah. But here's what's so weird, though, because in talking to the students or reading their papers that they write to me, they talk about how engaged they are and they love the material and this is the best thing. And so that's why it feels so strange to me, because I'll say, I don't know if any of you want to be in my class, and yet you write about how much you're getting from it. So there's some disconnect between the facial expressions and the nonverbal relationship we're having and what they're saying.
Well,
what is that, Kyle? I speak for this generation.
Now that I'm 30, I think I'm probably too old to speak for the real Gen Z people. But I do think that what you're saying resonates, and to go back to your earlier question about theater, I do find that there is a real desire, as much as there's an anxiety, there is a real desire also to be together in the same room and to engage either in a classroom intellectually or in a theater, emotionally or also intellectually, and be in the same space as other people engaging in this way. And then having that kind of internal transformation experience alongside other people who are having that experience.
Which is the beauty of live theater.
Yes, yeah, and the live classrooms. And, not to talk about the thing that is so over-talked about, but like AI and how much all information is just at really more than ever just at the touch of a finger. Like you can get basically so much information in a millisecond. Then it begs the question, well, what's the point of a university? What's the point of a theater space?
Yes.
And I don't think it's actually about information itself, because you could just get that quicker elsewhere. Mm-hmm. It's about this shared experience of self-interrogation, of questions that are shared in a space together, and of going through that kind of questioning process in a kind of physical co-presence.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Kyle Berlin. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and we're kind of talking about his exploration of theater and his work doing documentary playwriting that's leading up to the production that you've been working on here on the Central Coast, Mautini, Arab-American Oral History on the Central Coast. So let's jump a little bit to that. I hope we circle back around to the other conversations, because I think the whole idea of engagement and community engagement and people desiring to be together, even though there is this narrative of, like you said, coolness or kind of wanting to put down things that represent anything that was old school, and also the convenience of having everything on the phone makes it seductive to knock it out. But we'll circle back, and let's start off with why this topic about Arab American oral history on the Central Coast.
So the Maldini Project is not my – I mean, it's not my project. Basically, okay. This is a group, Our Roots, Our Routes, which is a collective of local people in the Arab American community who put together this project of gathering oral history interviews from Arab Americans who live on the Central Coast of all walks of life, all ages, and they, you know, they got grants, and they put a lot of energy and time into organizing this. They partnered with lots of different organizations and groups within the community, and then they conducted these oral history interviews with people, so with Arab Americans who are living here, and they recorded them, they audio recorded them, and then they've turned that into an exhibition, which was up at the Cal Poly Library and is presently up at the San Luis Obispo City Library on Palm Street. So I encourage people to go check out that exhibition, which features quotes from the oral history interviews. It has personal objects of care from some of the narrators. This group of people, a while ago, they approached me. I've been connected with one of them who, by a kind of community person who knew about my work, and we basically started a dialogue where she was saying, you know, we've got these, we're working on putting together these oral histories, you know, maybe we could collaborate on turning them into a live performance. And I said, yeah, that sounds amazing. And, you know, it's been over a year now and
wow.
months, but it's happening now, where they've basically given me the gift of having access to these oral history full recordings, which are hours and hours long. And eventually the hope is that they'll be released to the public on their website. So I also encourage people to look up the Maltini. If you just Google Maltini San Luis Obispo, you'll find their website.
And Maltini.
Yes.
Maltini.
And it's an Arabic word which means homeland. And so that's the sort of, you know, one of the overarching themes of the play. And although as I said, it's not my project, I would venture to say the project as well would be this idea of home and belonging and people speaking to what that means to them from their own experience.
How large is the Arab American community in the Central Coast?
You know, I don't know the numbers exactly,
okay.
But it's not huge. And a lot of the narrators in the oral history speak to that, the difference of coming here either from other urban centers in the U.S. where there were a lot more Arab Americans, mm-hmm. or from their home countries in the Middle East, where, you know, obviously they were surrounded by their fellow people who shared their nationality. So mm-hmm. That's part of the interest of the oral histories, is what's it like to be in this type of minority group in a semi-rural, semi-progressive, San Luis Obispo occupies this strange kind of central coast, but central in a lot of ways in
right.
between.
Because we have that coastal mindset as well as conservative ag mindset all existing in the same place and welcoming on various levels, various degrees of non-welcoming and welcoming. I mean, that's,
yeah.
I think, how most people would describe their experience on the Central Coast. It's not a super open door that says, please join us.
Yeah. And that, I mean, even that in that initial Arroyo Grande project I did, and in other projects I've done with Rhizome Theater, since then, locally, that's really been a recurrent theme of, on the one hand, a kind of people articulate how lovely and warm and people love living here, and on the other hand, there's this kind of dark side of,
but you're not really welcome.
Where are the lines and the limits and the borders of mm-hmm. acceptance and welcome, and who is actually welcome?
Which is why the whole happiest city in the United States always felt like such a false front door.
Yeah, definitely.
for people who have lived here for a long, long time. And also this theme of home, because that's been a recurring thing for you. I mean, I think you studied in Ireland and other places in Europe, this whole theme of home and how people define that. How does that play into how you look at your work?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, in Ireland I studied, you know, I've regretted it since. Maybe I should have studied theater or something more directly, but I decided to study what they called culture and colonialism degree master's program. So basically the history of colonialism in the world from an Irish university. So, you know, particularly a kind of anti-British Empire mm-hmm. perspective coming from Ireland. And, you know, the interesting thing about Ireland, not just if you allow me this digression, but to actually connect to this Maltini project and the Arab American stories. And you go to Ireland, and anyone who's visited might remember this, especially in Northern Ireland, but across Ireland, there's Palestinian flags everywhere. Hmm. Well before the current conflict, well before, you know, October 7th and the Israeli attack on Gaza this time, there have been Palestinian flags. And the reason that is because there's a real Irish solidarity historically with Palestine mm-hmm. as a sort of similarly occupied territory. The Irish, you know, feel themselves to be occupied by a British Empire in the same way that Palestine is an occupied territory in the West Bank and other places. So this kind of and actually that's what I wrote my master's thesis on, was the solidarity between Irish Republican movements. When I say Republican, I mean the Republic, as in the Republic of Ireland,
yes.
not American
not as a politics.
Party.
Yeah. Yes. So
anyway, this kind of connection between, well, what does home mean mm-hmm. for people who live under occupation, or for people who have been forced from their homelands, or whose homelands are currently occupied, or who cannot return, who are living in exile, or who are living as immigrants elsewhere. And so these sort of shifting boundary lines of home and belonging and what it has to do with power. I would say, also to answer your earlier question, that's a way that I think my work has shifted slightly, as I'm focusing more and interested more directly in, well, what are the power dynamics at play on a larger scale, and how do they play out in personal stories and on an intimate scale?
And can we ever really, because the definition of power is always so interesting. It's very difficult to define power. You just know when you don't have it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ultimately how people describe power. You know if you don't have it. And I think that's a really challenging thing to take on, because the desire to feel like we have personal power then I think would lead people to try to lay claim, you know, with terms like my land, my home, my family. There seems to be this ongoing generations of searching for a sense of belonging or feeling like we have power in some place. I mean, going back to the serfdoms, where no one, you know, unless you were the very small elite, had any ownership of anything. And so those working as serfs were handing over all of their goods, that searching for some sort of sense of solidarity. I mean, is there ever a time that any of us really can claim home, and how do we really define that?
Yeah, I mean it's a complex. It's a great question.
As soon as I started going out of my mouth, I was like, "This is too." I don't know where we go with it.
I mean, I definitely can't answer it with any certainty. I can, you know, I think, I don't know. It's also, you know, you mentioned this last play that I was working on about the Dana Reserve project,
yes,
and
yes.
the planned felling of almost 4,000 mature oak trees to build a new housing development, and et cetera. And so much of that play, which you collaborated on as well, was about home also, and
yes.
and who gets to decide what happens to land, and you know, who can claim land as their own, historically or within systems of law, and how arbitrary our determinations of ownership and of stewardship and of care, and all these things are super. You know, I think we don't generally think of the United States. Those of us who are, you know, living in the belly of the United States, who are just here as Americans, and I don't think there's a lot of kind of education, generally speaking, about thinking about the United States as an empire, as a colonial force that's colonized not only other places beyond the current borders of the United States, but also within these 50 states, and thinking about, well, what does it mean to claim home within that context?
And to be from a place where, and again, never would have used the term empire in describing the United States, but wow, how different to turn the verbiage that way and how different to look at it. But for everyone who is here because of happenstance of their birth, which is a whole different piece, it's like happenstance of birth is different than sailing over and claiming land. And so what happens to those generations later when it's happenstance of birth that you're here? And also I remember reading a book that this man wrote talking about the eternal restlessness of all Americans because they are home nowhere in the United States, ultimately, as opposed to indigenous people who can go 4,000 years back to one rock outcropping, that there is this forever searching and sense of almost restlessness was the word, that no American can ever really feel settled because they're not ever really home.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to counter your reading with my own suggestion of reading that we've been immersed in for this play that, you know, that we're working on. There's this really excellent, kind of well-known essay by the Palestinian-American scholar and writer Edward Said, S-A-I-D, on exile. And it was published in the 80s, and it's one of the best meditations that I've read about these questions, like you just said, about, well, what does it mean to claim home when you can't actually be rooted? And he quotes lots of other thinkers talking about the fundamental need of the human soul to feel rooted, mm-hmm. and the kind of contradiction between nationalism, which can be such a negative force and such a violent force on the one hand, mm-hmm. but then on the other hand, nationalism as a kind of rallying cry of belonging, of, well, this is, for example, in the Palestinian case, you know, to be this is a people, this is where we've lived for centuries, this is a cry for our
identity.
Own existence and
mm-hmm.
identity,
yeah.
and having a kind of holding that contradiction of not wanting to become overdetermined on fixed identity, but also recognizing that that's where to go back to power, that's how one can leverage power for oneself or gain a kind of power that other forces, other empires would rather not see exist.
Right, to shut it down, to make more room for their own sense
exactly.
of home. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Kyle Berlin. We're talking about his recent, I guess, collaborative project, Mautini, Arab American Oral History on the Central Coast. And we're going to take a quick break and come back and continue the conversation and also open up the phone lines if you'd like to join us today at 805-781-3875. We'd love to hear from you. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night.
Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist and my guest, Kyle Berlin. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to join in our conversation as we explore Kyle's latest collaborative project, Mautini, Arab American Oral History on the Central Coast. We may say produced or put together by Verbatim Theater. Is that correct?
Well, Verbatim Theater is the sort of style of theater generally where, you know, you take quotes and use them verbatim, that is precisely. So it's just, this is a kind of project that I'm doing, you know, as me, Kyle Berlin, and then collaborating with my longtime friend and collaborator, Margaret Wright. And then we also have a few of the narrators who recorded oral history interviews, mm-hmm. part of the Arab American community for the Mautini project more generally, who will be helping us read and perform the play on Thursday.
Right. So let's talk about this. So it's coming up this week, Thursday night.
Yeah. So this Thursday at 5 p.m., from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Slo County Library at 985 Palm Street. Okay. And you can people can get tickets. It's a sort of sliding scale donation or free, you know, basically pay what you want donation to support the Mautini Project. And you, if people are interested in getting their tickets, they can just Google Mautini, M-A-W-T-I-N-E, San Luis Obispo.
Is it T-I-N-I or T-I-N-E?
Sorry, T-I-N-I. You're right. I mix up my I's and my E's.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. on 805 Tix, and you can register there. And it's a two-hour event, and it'll be about an hour of our performance, half hour of people are going to be bringing food, Middle Eastern food that they're going to make, and the people can visit the exhibition that the Mautini Project has put together. That's on the second floor of the library. So it's going to be a whole kind of immersive experience.
So it starts at 5. Does your performance start at 5, or is that kind of opening up to the potluck and the visiting the displays?
Yeah. So from 5 to 5:30 is mm-hmm. the sort of potluck and the visiting the exhibition. And then the performance will be roughly from 5:30 to 6:30. And then from 6:30 to 7, we're going to have a community dialogue reflecting on, you know, everything that we just heard in the performance.
So what surprised you about this project? What did you not expect in listening to these narratives?
Well, that's a good question. It's amazing to hear such in-depth interviews with people who are covering such vast, you know, experiences of their life from early childhood or even going back, you know, before they were even born, to their grandparents and their histories of migration. Because, you know, this is like any kind of immigrant group, and like you said before, basically almost everyone except for indigenous people in this country are immigrants at some point not that long ago. And so, you know, tracing this histories of migration, whether recent or in you know, ancestors, is super amazing to just hear people speak so clearly and like being able to remember and recount with such precision.
What's the age span of people that you talk to or are you sharing in the show?
Yeah, so
I don't know how to describe what it is that you're sharing in the performance.
Yeah, so in the oral history, the Mautini archives in general, I'm not qualified to speak. I don't know, you know, the full range, but I know for this production, the interviews that we were given access to and shared with range from someone who's currently in at Cal Poly, actually, mm-hmm. To someone who's in their, to a couple people who are in their 80s. So a vast range. And people are coming from different countries or were born in the U.S., but their parents or grandparents came from different countries. And, you know, one of the things that was recurrent, I mean, this is just a small thing, but I was just talking with one of the narrators about this yesterday, was the kind of uncanny similarity that a lot of them speak to in the interviews between San Luis Obispo and the climate and geography of this area and the home country of Lebanon or Palestine, people speak, or Syria, people all spoke about the strange similarities in being drawn to this area because it reminds them of their home there.
I wouldn't have thought that, not having any geographical experience.
Yeah, the Mediterranean climate and the sort of mountains and, So that was interesting.
And is there a takeaway from the experience or more of a just a snapshot into the lives of these people? Because I know that there's been themes, you know, to most of your productions.
Yeah, I mean, the I think, you know, the oral history archive itself is so rich and so vast, and people have such vastly differing experiences. But there are these kind of recurring themes and motifs that seem to occur in a lot of the interviews. And so for this performance, what we'll be kind of focusing on broadly is this arc and position of the exile. And what does it mean to not be fully at home in one's home? Mm-hmm. And how is that actually maybe an advantage? Mm. Maybe it's a part of morality to not be fully comfortable where one is because one can see what's actually going on more clearly, or one has...
When they're stepped away from...
Exactly, the sight. So that's one of the themes that we're talking about. And then we'll also want to talk about... you know, to reference Edward Said, this famed Palestinian-American scholar... late scholar again, who he has this idea of contrapuntal reading. So point, counterpoint, contrapuntal, an idea from music of within, you know, a sort of polyphonic, multiple melodies that are happening at one time. We hear one note, but actually there's all these other notes that are, you know, maybe slightly, if we tune our ears slightly differently, we could hear them as well. Mm-hmm. Or to think of a theatrical metaphor, what's happening on stage, well, that's made possible by all these things that are happening off stage that maybe we're not seeing. So to kind of flip the focus to, you know, a slightly different perspective and giving more context to these narratives that are so honestly shallow and non-contextualized when we're reading about the Middle East in mainstream media or the way that it's covered. I think most Americans, including me, you know, have a pretty cursory understanding of the region, of the United States histories in the region, of all this complexities underneath. So we're trying to bring that out a little bit more.
Well, what I keep visualizing as you're talking is this idea of the dominant truth, that every culture has a dominant truth, and that's the story that everyone kind of follows to be the truth of an area. So whoever's in power determines the dominant truth of a nation. And yet there are a million smaller truths that operate underneath that all the time. And they're just as vibrant and just as alive as that one dominant truth. And when you're thinking about it, then I just visualize all the people and the stories. When you're looking at this micro version of this community on the Central Coast, which is also very small, so it kind of parses down to the human experience. And when we read a tweet or, you know, something that says we're going to bomb a civilization out of existence, there's never any connection to the human beings or the people. And I think with the Palestinian, you know, in Gaza and any place where there are giant just genocides of human beings, we're so numb to the human story that people feel less important because we can't imagine their lives. And when you say that for the people here, for many of the Arab Americans that you spoke to, this reminds them of their homeland, that changes. Like, oh, no, I just thought it was a giant desert somewhere across the ocean that couldn't be at all valuable. But you're talking about a richness and a feeling of a landscape that is inhabited by people that somehow gets dismissed when we talk about power and control and wanting to dominate the world.
I think you put it beautifully. It feels all the more urgent in this, at this time and in this context.
This week,
you know, that there's these, as you said, there's these real human lives that are lived beneath the kind of destruction and erasure of them that empire and violence create. And I think it's a power of oral history and of this type of theater in general, of listening to the real words of everyday people. There's this kind of, we put so much focus on the, you know, the big names and those few names that we all know, but there's this kind of richness and culture that is borne forward by everyday, ordinary people. And to give them cultural space and to honor those voices over and against empire and domination and violence and crassness and decontextual stupidity is the whole point, for me anyway.
Ridiculousness.
Ridiculousness, yes. That's the word. And to use another word you used at the beginning, overwhelm. I think so much actually a part of the, as I say in my introduction that I wrote for the piece, part of the kind of nefarious intent of empire and those in power is to do such an onslaught, both physical and metaphorical, of misinformation, of information, of violence, of changing goalposts, of changing narratives, of insults and attacks, again, literal and dehumanization, and desubjectifying people who are full human beings, that we get overwhelmed. And this itself is part of the intent. So to fight against this overwhelm by zooming into the specificity of individual lives and the richness, the texture, the memories of small experiences that testify ultimately to these vast dehumanizing scales of big experience.
My guest today is Kyle Berlin. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to be part of the conversation. It frightens me how easily, even in my own brain, things can lose the human connection that is so big and feels so overwhelming that I have to really focus on the individual human experience of having bombs blow up. You know, because I'm listening to a story and people are talking about bombs are going off and yet the kids are going to school or the family's still having dinner. And that's so out of my realm of consciousness that I can't process it. And so it kind of gets shut down. And I think, as you said before, that's part of the overwhelm, is that if we talk in terms of annihilation and regimes and, you know, words that sound scary, then the human piece of it gets lost. And it feels easier to accept what's happening. And also, for the people who support what's happening, the conviction with which they talk about our right to wipe out a civilization in the name of Christian nationalism, like all of that, again, that feeling of a fire hose coming at my face.
Exactly. Yeah. And that there's this kind of abstraction that happens, that, like you say, that just makes you unable to feel. And I think that's
and I'm trying to feel.
Yeah. And imagine those, and there are many who aren't.
Right.
And so it's a challenge. I mean, unfortunately, I don't think that verbatim theater is going to save us from that dehumanizing thing, but it's one small point of contact, of presence, of sensitivity and compassion and awareness, and trying to give a more human scale of instead of the fire hose, a drinking fountain.
You know? Something that's gentle.
Yeah.
Well, and then as we talked about at the beginning, the importance of somehow reinitiating people into community spaces, because if we look at long term impacts of COVID, long COVID on our social communities, that feels important to find a way to inspire people to actually come together for anything.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a real need to, as one of the narrators in this oral history archive speaks about, he said, you know, going around and seeing while his family and people that he knows are being bombed in Gaza, and seeing people just no one, like he said, you know, no one was caring. He talks about needing to find space where he can be with other people who, you know, he recognized it may not be as important to them as it is to him because they don't have that personal connection, but right, they're able to care, or they're able to be in that space, and they're informed enough, and they have that heart position enough to care. That feels important to him.
It's a community grieving. It's a community grieving. We don't have to have known the person who died to understand what grief feels like. So we don't have to live in the place where someone feels lost to not be, you know, to be able to empathize with that. And I think that's part of the, you know, I just keep going back to the importance of getting people out of their bubbles, their spaces, and into more complex and diverse spaces so that the communications and the opportunities to feel expand. Because I don't know about you, but I'm having a hard time literally feeling.
Yeah.
And that's been for the last 5 years, that my capacity to feel anything has really been challenged. Our number is 805-781-3875. And Maury is on the air. Hey, thanks for hanging on and waiting for us. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I didn't catch my name. There you go.
Thank you.
So first of all, Elizabeth, thanks so much for your program and what you talk about and the various voices that you bring on the air. I really appreciate it as a community member.
Thank you.
It means a lot.
I appreciate you.
I just in commenting on what you were both just talking about, having had the opportunity to attend other performances that are documentary style, I find that it is a different entry point into hearing various voices, which connects me to what you two were just sharing.
Yeah.
And it is hard. It is hard for me, at least in this current environment, things that are happening.
Yes.
So one of the questions, though, I have for your guest is, I understand about the program that's happening on Thursday. Sounds really amazing. I want to know, how would I learn more about future projects?
That is. What is in the future for Kyle Berlin, documentary playwright?
Well, thanks for that question. I feel, you know, I'm very focused on this one right now,
mm-hmm.
But I hope to regroup after and think about what's next. Although I know I can say, you know, you can, anyone who's listening can visit rhizometheater.org for the future of Rhizome projects. This is a project, this one that I'm working on by myself, but Rhizome Theater, we're hoping to do a play about the nuclear debates, historical and current, around Diablo Canyon. Also nuclear, just the idea of nuclear in general. Mm-hmm. We want to do some interviews with local activists, local people on all sides of this issue, and hope to have that production maybe later this year. I floated with some other collaborators an idea of a play about marriage.
Yes. I would be the other collaborator.
I didn't want to call you out.
No, but this is a heart-centered project that you and I have been talking about for a year. The much maligned institution of marriage and how it can actually be a healthy stabilizer for culture and community. Did you have an idea for a future project?
I mostly just wanted to make sure there was a way to find out where those projects, you know, if they were coming, where you would find out about them. And if I was in a community that was interested in a certain topic, that I would know where to go to reach Kyle or his group.
Thank you.
So that I would know.
Okay. So, and spell, thank you for the call. Spell Rhizome for people who might want to find you.
So for Rhizome Theater, which is me and Ashlyn Hatch, Rhizome Theater, RHIZOME.org. Wait, Rhizome, that's Rhizome, and then theater, theater.org.
So it's rhizometheater.org.
Yep, and you can email us there, or you can reach out to me for, you know, other things at kyle.m.berlin@gmail.com.
it looks like you're rethinking that professional email address.
It's not, yeah. I mean, it's true. I'm always... This is my lifestyle, is that I'm kind of always open to new projects. And that's how this Mautini project happened, is, you know, someone just approached me and it just sort of organically arose. And so I am kind of my ear to the ground always. So if anyone out there, you know, wants to collaborate or has ideas,
yes,
let's talk.
And you can also send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, because I am in touch with kyle.m.berlin@gmail.com. All right. So in our last minute or so, Kyle, please introduce what's happening Thursday night once again.
Yes. So on Thursday night from 5 to 7 p.m. at the SLO County Library in Palm Street, it's the Mautini Verbatim Theater narratives of home and belonging. You can register for free online at 805-TICS.
They just want to count. You just want to count.
We just want to count.
There's no charge unless you'd like to donate.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And everyone is invited. There'll be food. There'll be performance and narrators, Arab American narratives of home and belonging here on the Central Coast, our neighbors and family and friends, and hope to provide some human faces to, you know, broad stories that are dehumanizing, as we
and rarely
about.
Ever heard.
Yeah.
And along with the evening, it starts at 5, there is an exhibition there at the library that's been up for a while and will be up there for a little longer. Tell me the group that originally started collecting the oral histories.
It's Our Roots, Our Routes. Our Routes, Our Roots. I forget the order, but it's, you know, roots as in tree roots,
yes.
And then routes or roots as in ways. So
how
it's
we
about migration.
Oh, I like that. That's clever. Nice. Our Roots, Our Routes.
Yeah, so you can please look them up, and they're the people who made this, you know, this oral history archive and are putting it all together. I'm just the performance guy on the side, but it's really their beautiful project, and I want to shout them out.
Absolutely,
so
and also for the potluck that they'll be provided,
absolutely.
So people can come and enjoy community. Because I guess at the end of the day, you know, the more we know each other, human to human, the more our world makes sense. Everything else just is noise and a fire hose in our face. Kyle, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find me on Facebook, Instagram. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Podcast or show. Share it with your friends. But as always, thank you for being a part of this community, tuning in every Tuesday at 2, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
We were born before the wind, also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sailed into the mystic. Oh, I can now hear the sailors cry. Smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. I don't have to fear that I wanna rock your gypsy soul. Just like way back in the days of old. How magnificently we will fold into the mystic.